Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are going to reverse the order of sharing. Normally, we begin with health and nutrition, then go to our guest, then to important environmental issues, and then to social commentary. Well, we're going to have our guests first, then we will deal with the following issues. British Petroleum workers report low morale, lack of pay, and sickness. Also, we're going to talk about Obama appointing a top Bush crony to a top drug enforcer position, and all of us who have pushed hard to change that policy are going to ask for him not to make that choice. Virtually every important choice Obama has made in this entire administration has been either a Clinton or Bush person, and we believe that that's wrong. But get a true progressive in there. Lobbyists promote asbestos use in the developing world and depleted uranium weapons behind the rise in cancer. Also, the great decoupling of corporate profits for jobs. That's important because when you hear that Wall Street's happy with what's happening in the market, of course they are. And corporations are profitable? Absolutely. Some more profitable than any other time. But why? Because their workers are benefiting? No. Because they're cutting workers, cutting inventory. They're cutting themselves lean to the bone. That's how they're making their profit. Well, that means they're not going to be bringing those workers back because those workers would be additional expenses. So I'll give you the input on that. Separately, and very important, a toxic black rain falling in the Gulf. I predicted this about a month and a half ago, that you cannot just consider what's in the water of the Gulf. You have to realize that that is made up of many different volatile chemicals, which then go into the air with precipitate matter, rain, and then fog, and go over the land. It's happening. You'll hear first about it. But let's now go to my guest who's standing by, Tom Engelhardt. And we're going to talk about a different angle on the Wikileaks leaking 90,000-plus important documents. Now, I was listening to all the major programs last night and today, and I didn't want to repeat what they had, but I did want to challenge some of what was said. And we will do that, and we will give you a different perspective on this, and that's what we try to do every day. Tom Engelhardt is one of the nation's most important commentators on America's military adventures and their impact upon our culture and economy. He is founder of the Nation Institute's progressive blog, tomsdispatch.com, and is co-founder with Steve Frazier of the American Empire Project, a publishing endeavor to investigate the adverse effect of America's imperial efforts, which have impacted democracy, which includes notable individuals such as Noam Chomsky, Chalmers Johnson, and Michael Clare. He is the author of The End of Victory Culture, which dealt with the illusions of the Cold War, and his newest book is The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. And it examines in great detail and insight the past decade of our wars in the Middle East. Nice to have you with us today, Tom.
Good to be here, Gary.
Tom, already I've observed a subtle whitewashing of the documents in some quarters, significance of both the government and the mainstream media. For example, talking heads are saying there is nothing especially new. Perhaps the amount of content is more than expected, but we're being told this has all been known already. If that's the case, then why didn't the media truly report and comment on this during the past years? And we're hearing that the White House and the Pentagon have always known the precarious nature of the Pakistan government, its military and intelligence. But then why do we not hear this being mentioned in the context of a fundamental problem in our entire strategy to stabilize Afghanistan. And they make no mention of the drones, which is no secret except that their rate of failure and mishaps seems to be much more common than originally believed. And finally, it is as if instead of the documents being an eruption, they're attempting to make it into a ripple. So I would like you, if you would please, to first give us the analysis of what you see happening in the mainstream media and the administration, and then second, what do you believe is the most important new information, if any, we're getting, if we're getting all the reports? And finally, do you foresee anything really coming of any of this?
Okay, let's start. WikiLeaks, which is this kind of stateless media organization, which got from, we don't really know from whom, although we might take a guess, got these documents from somebody within probably the military or the intelligence community or somebody's, shared them with three organizations. They shared them with the New York Times, the Guardian, the British Guardian, and Der Spiegel. And that is, they gave those papers access to them ahead of time to increase the impact. To get at your point, If you look at how the New York Times covered these 90,000 odd documents and how the British Guardian covered it, you see something interesting. The Times launched its piece yesterday, a front page piece, a huge four pages, four columns each. It was a staggering amount of space for the shrunken Times. They launched it with the story, we've been double-crossed by Pakistan. They certainly say the war looks grimmer and so on and so forth, but you have to get off the front page through the first two pages of four columns each and to the third page through a couple of columns before you get to dead civilians. Now, The Guardian started their piece by saying this is a far grimmer picture than we've seen before, and then they had the sentence, which was really, I think, the second sentence of their piece: coalition forces have killed hundreds of civilians in unreported incidents. What they saw, in other words, if you simply look at the coverage by these two organizations of the same set of documents, you might have thought, if you weren't reading really carefully, that they were actually, that they had actually gotten into different sets of documents, not the same set of documents. I think it's pretty typical of American coverage generally, and coverage more generally of this WikiLeaks leak, that the part of the story that's generally pushed to the side, it goes very much with the phrase that we use for it, which is collateral damage. We call the deaths of civilians in our wars abroad collateral damage, as if it's a sideline thing, even though the deaths of civilians increasingly in modern war, and certainly in American wars, is the central fact of the wars, and it's a motivating fact in what happens in these wars. The Guardian got that story right, and the Times really didn't. And I think a lot of the coverage that I've seen, now I haven't seen the TV part of it, I've seen the press part of it, has been along those lines. On your second issue, which is what's new and what isn't, here's what I would say. Without bragging about TomDispatch.com, which has been covering this for years, if you had been reading Tom Dispatch, you would not have found the news in these 90,000 documents particularly new. I mean, in other words, there was new information. For instance, that the Taliban has missiles, shoulder-held missiles they've got some shoulder-held missiles that can shoot down helicopters, and this was covered up by the U.S. government. At least one helicopter was shot down, and this is potentially modestly significant. It's something we didn't know in any case. Some of the incidents that are mentioned, we really didn't know. They hadn't been covered before. But if you had been following something like Tom Dispatch, you would generally know what these documents had to say. But if you were just out there in America and not spending special time on this war, you wouldn't. And you wouldn't largely because the war has not been on the front pages of our papers. And I think in some ways the most significant part of this story isn't what's literally in the documents, even though it's very important that the documents were released, but the simple fact that for the second time in a month, the first time being General McChrystal's firing and the accession to the war commandership of General Petraeus. For the second time in a month, the increasingly unpopular Afghan war has been put in an unflattering way on the front pages of American papers, at the top of the TV news, and so on and so forth. And that, I think, may be the most significant part of this in terms of its impact.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Just a brief comment, then I'll go to my second question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I voted for Ralph Nader, and a lot of people voted for Barack Obama within the progressive and certainly on the left or liberal groups. Why is it at this moment that we are not demonstrating and demanding a cessation of the funding for the war, and ask him to honor his original promises during his campaign that he was not a pro-war person? I know a lot of people voted for him with the thought or belief that he would not continue the excursions in Iraq and would pull out of Afghanistan, and they were absolutely blindsided by the idea that he now has at 67% of all the people in Afghanistan under arms are private contractors, which he can conveniently keep out of the statistics. Oh, we're withdrawing this amount. Same thing in Iraq. Oh, we're going to withdraw these soldiers. But you're replacing, for every soldier withdrawal, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, you're putting in a private contractor who can do the same business. Why can't we just speak with one voice and say, these wars are not winnable. We're not going to democratize this area of the world. We have no business being there. They had no al-Qaeda. They had no major insurgency groups in Iraq before we created them. Why can't we just stand up and speak to Obama?
And let me add one thing to the question, which I'm going to be unable to answer, but I will discuss. And that is that, you know, it's worth adding to that, that if we were to succeed in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I wrote about this, I mean, succeed in the sense that, say, Petraeus succeeded in Iraq, which is pulling it back from the brink, et cetera, et cetera. If we were to blunt the Taliban, you know, and get modest control over a country, over the fifth poorest, second most corrupt country in the world, the world's premier narco state, if we were to do that, as of this moment, there are, according to the CIA director, there are only maximum 50 to 100 operatives, not leaders, al-Qaeda operatives, in Iraq to begin with. If we controlled Iraq, we would in no way have made the U.S. safer from terrorist attack, which is much overblown anyway, but in other words, on the same principle, we would then have to invade the Pakistani tribal borderlands, where a lot of the old al-Qaeda actually is. We would have to take Yemen. We would have to take Somalia. We would have to take country after country, which is inconceivable. And so just on the basis that they're presenting the Afghan war, you know, it literally makes no sense in terms of American safety at this point. I mean, particularly when we're pouring all that money into it and could be putting that money into everything that you talk about and we know, aging infrastructure and everything else in the United States. Now, on the question of why, that is, where are the American people? I think all I can do is ask the same question. I can say the one thing I can say is that, in a way, one of the great successes of the military in the wake of Vietnam, if you remember, Vietnam, of course, was a citizen's army, and by the end of the war, by the last years of the war, it was in literal revolt and in chaos. And when the military came out of Vietnam, of course, they never wanted to fight another counterinsurgency war, give them credit for that, and they just put counterinsurgency behind them, but they also decided that the way you were to fight wars in the future was you were to have an all-volunteer force, which would not be a citizen's army in essence. I mean, it might have citizens in it, obviously, but it would not be a citizen's army. And the American people would be less involved in any wars that were then fought far away like this, you know, for, let's say, imperial or ill purposes. And I think they were thinking about this. They formed their volunteer army. In the wake of that, you know, in more recent years, they also, as you were mentioning about contractors, they privatized the army. They've created this whole vast mercenary corps around it so that today in Afghanistan you have one, at least one private contractor for every American soldier who's there. I mean, almost 100,000 American soldiers right now, and last figures I've seen, maybe 110,000 to 120,000 contractors, many of whom are Afghans, but nonetheless. So they both privatized war, and they've taken war away from the populace and put the burden of it on a tiny percentage of Americans. And as a consequence, Americans are remarkably detached from their wars, and particularly detached from the Afghan war, I think largely because the 9/11 attacks have always given it a pass in a way that even the Iraq war didn't have. So my answer is I remain, like you, startled that you know, with a Democratic administration, which actually theoretically would have to listen to its base if it got out there in the streets, people aren't out there in the streets. My only explanation is that Americans, we live in a reasonably peaceable land after a fashion, and we are now detached. We feel almost no connections to the wars being fought distantly, which until recently have been kept remarkably off the front pages of the papers, which is the importance of the WikiLeaks dump.
Okay, good. Now let's just extend that thought for a moment. I did a film called Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, and about 12 minutes of the film was shot in Fallujah, and there was a physician who said, would you show something that's horrible, but it's necessary, and that was photos of the dead babies in the hospital who died from very, very damaging genetic defects, two brains, all forms of this. And I said, why do you want this? And he said, because your media comes over here and they show your heroic soldiers, how much they suffer. Nothing is shown about depleted uranium, the high incidence of death, the children who've died from sanctions, the lack of electricity in the poor areas to 1 hour a day, and even in the wealthier areas to 6 hours a day, the fact that we're frequently operating without anesthesia. And we don't get this. We don't understand why, if you're going to be reporting on a war, you can't report upon the consequences of that war to the civilians. Now, one of the things I got from this leaked documents catch is that they were showing there's far more Taliban, far more armed insurgents of the country. It showed also that we are doing a lot of collateral damage. And even today, the Afghan government officially says there's 54 dead civilians hid in this one building they went to took refuge, and NATO and America saying there were no, and then it turns out that they were saying no, and they hadn't even been to the village yet. And this is showing that we have intentionally lied about this. So if our government is intentionally lying, if we're not being told the truth, and then Bill O'Reilly says, this is terrible because it puts our troops at danger. I see no danger at all that it can put our troops in, that they're not already in. It's just making the people who are the policymakers look what they are as deceitful and not in any way wanting us to know the truth, as they didn't want us to know the truth in Vietnam. But as there were a lot of good journalists there, photojournalists and others, who brought us a story. What would happen if we had people there bringing us the real story, including the story of everything happening? Would you think that would change Americans' mind if we actually saw it on television and made us a little uncomfortable?
Yes, I think. I mean, again, I'm struck by the fact that that the Times simply didn't. I mean, I don't think that they were simply covering up collateral damage. I don't think it was anything as direct as that. I think they just didn't even look at it as a particularly good compared to Pakistanis being involved with the Taliban, compared to certain aspects of things with American troops and the overall situation of the war. I don't think they considered collateral damage particularly important. They don't look at it. I mean, these are civilians very far away who are dying. You know, the other day, just to start with your Fallujah point, Patrick Coburn, who's probably the best, I think, personally, maybe the best, he's a British and he works for The Independent over in Britain, and he has just been a spectacular reporter in Iraq, a very brave guy. And he reported from Fallujah recently that and again, this was a study done. It came out of Ulster. It was not actually an Iraqi study, but a study of birth defects in Fallujah, of small children's birth defects particularly. And the rates, they claimed, at least in this story, and he's very reliable, were higher than in Hiroshima. This is for kids with all kinds of birth defects, mutations, so on and so forth. Now, I know nothing personally about this, but I was struck by that. It was exactly the point you were making. The WikiLeaks documents clearly show that there are a lot of incidents of civilian deaths at our hands which are covered up. And just from a purely practical point of view, of course, you know, every time you kill a civilian in a society like that, in any society, including ours, you're also, you know, you're injuring all the people around them, all the people in their extended network, all the people in their village. You create a lot of enemies. So it's kind of a hopeless war to fight in this way, because you cannot fight a war like this without killing civilians. I don't care what rules you put into effect. So this issue of killing civilians is, I think, a very central one. And of course, the problem is when we look at 9/11, for instance. I mean, I was in New York in 9/11. You know, almost everybody, if you were living there, had some connection to somebody who died there. And, you know, we cherish every one of those people. We put up their biography. You know, we give them, each one of them, special attention over years. But when it comes to Afghans dying in, when you add it all up, far larger numbers. I mean, some of them have died at the hands of the Taliban, of course. But the ones who have died at our hands, I mean, you can pile them up into towers, and we don't care. We call that our safety or our security. I mean, it's a very dangerous attitude to have in the world, I think.
Oh, it's not thinking. Show me a single one of the 41 people in an extended Afghan family, that's how many there are, that would say, we're happy that person's dead. We're better off with that person dead or that child dead. No, they will never forget. And when you realize how many casualties, how many injuries, how many displaced people we have made, we're impacting mostly Afghan people. My next issue is...
But just before we get to that, let me just say one other thing in response to your last thing, because one of the things I've done at Tom Dispatch quite regularly is I've followed the question of civilian deaths, particularly in Afghanistan, elsewhere in Iraq and elsewhere, but particularly in Afghanistan. And one of the striking things, because you brought up this issue of the claim, which, by the way, came out of Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan's office, that an American missile attack had killed 52 innocent civilians, mostly women and children. This is in the last day or two. And the American denial, the NATO denial that this had happened, and the, of course, joint investigation that supposedly is going on right now, although they haven't yet reached the village. I followed these incidents like this very carefully, and while it could be that there's a mistake here, that it didn't happen, whatever, almost every one of them, where you've had an Afghan account and the American denial, the American denial has proved to be false. So, you know, either mistaken, false, a cover-up, call it what you will, but it's a startling record in which time after time I feel a reasonable confidence when I see a story like this without having followed it out. And then I do follow it out. I feel reasonable confidence that when the American or NATO spokesmen say, you know, we didn't do it, we know nothing about it, you know, or alternately, as is often the case, they claim that it wasn't initially, that it wasn't, you know, 17 women and 27 kids or something, but a bunch of Taliban insurgents. It almost so regularly turns out when we end up with the story, which we don't always, it almost invariably turns out that the Afghan reports are right and the American denials were wrong. And we now know from the WikiLeaks document dump, we know more clearly that in some of these specific cases that Americans knew very quickly that this was so and nonetheless went on with their denials and that they were cover-ups.
In some respects, it reminds you of the documentary Control Room about the Iraq War and the lies and the manipulation of the media. During the Bush regime, we saw Condoleezza Rice basically giving India pretty much anything it wanted on a golden platter, including nuclear know-how, military collaboration, and stronger economic ties. So, of course, Pakistan feels threatened by this. Next, Pakistan, I'm sure, does not want a strong, independent Afghanistan on its borders. In fact, Pakistan actually controlling Afghanistan would be a huge boon, since it's rich in minerals and metals and oil. Well, Pakistan already has India to its east. Then on its west is Iran. No love lost there, since Iran is Shia and Pakistan doesn't permit Shia mosques and schools and open public displays of worship, such as during their festival of Muharram. And most of the headwaters of all the rivers watering Pakistan's agricultural lands originate in India. I believe much of the real underlying causes of the conflict in Kashmir concerns water resources. I could be wrong, but I believe that's an important part of it, since six rivers begin in that area, and India is slowly restricting more and more water from going to Pakistan. Pakistan will be an environmental nightmare with a growing population and less water resources in the not-too-far future. So when we piece these scenarios together, and what do we get from this? And if you could, the average American is ignorant of the 21 ruling families of Pakistan. We never hear about them controlling, like warlords and shoguns, everything in their territory. You can't open a business in one of their territories unless you give some patronage respect, and they're a silent collaborator in your business. And we never hear about them. We never hear about the power of the schools in Pakistan as a breeding ground for the next generation of terrorists. We never hear about where our money actually goes, because once it gets there, the billions of dollars they've received, there's no accountability for it. And now these leaked documents are giving us a very sobering assessment, and yet we turn right around and last night on Van Susteren, she had this Bolton on, and he's trumped out all the time. Says, "Well, yes, they're not, they're not the best of people, but they're the best we can find." As if, okay, let's just continue everything because there's no one else that's going to support our efforts there. Your thoughts on all these, please?
Wow, that's a big picture. Americans are terrible on history. We tend to, it's often to our advantage to forget it, I think, and we forget that we think of the Afghan war as a long war, 9 years already, or just about, and that's long enough. But it's hard to keep in mind the fact that, in fact, we have on and off been fighting in Afghanistan for 30 years, and we've done that in conjunction with the Pakistanis. And in conjunction with the Pakistanis, CIA in particular, with the backing of the Reagan administration, and starting in 1979-80, began pouring money into the anti-Soviet war in Afghanistan. And it wasn't just that we poured the money in, but we poured it in through two very conservative groups. We poured it in through with the help of the Saudis, and we poured it in with the help of Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. And they, in turn, gave it to the most extreme of the jihadists who were fighting the Soviets. Now, that was the 1980s. When the war was over, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we didn't care about Afghanistan, and we just turned our backs and forgot about it. The Pakistanis, as you point out very clearly, it's extremely important to the Pakistanis, to whatever Pakistani government you have in power, given the fact that they've got a hostile power on one side, even two sides, that on that third side, they don't have a hostile power. And it was the Pakistanis, that same ISI, who basically created the Taliban. You know, we forget all this. Well, we just didn't give a darn. Now, their interests, it's the same, as you say, it's the same, in essence, the same Pakistan, the same ruling families, the same military, their interests remain the same. This can't be shocking. And, of course, this part of the WikiLeaks document dump, if you've been following this, is not particularly shocking. I mean, people have been saying for years, to what extent we don't know, that the Pakistani intelligence service is connected, still connected, to to the Taliban, to various militants in various parts of the Pakistani tribal areas who are fighting us and so on and so forth. But of course, let's keep in mind that some of those groups, like the Haqqani Network, for instance, were the very people, the very extremists our money supported in the 1980s. We're now fighting some of the same people. Of course, there are whole new generations of Taliban and so on. But some of the leaders, two crucial ones, who were utterly extreme and who today Americans, if they thought back, would be shocked to realize that we had ever supported the most fundamentalist of fundamentalist believers and jihadists who we put our money into. Now we're fighting them. And now, of course, they're terrible people. Mm. Now they're blackguards. But the Pakistan's interest, the problem in the area is we are allied with Pakistan, we're trying to fight a war, and Pakistan's interests and our interests are not the same, just objectively speaking. I mean, the interests of that government and the interests of Washington are simply not the same. And in fact, it's clear that the pressure that the WikiLeaks events will put on the Obama administration at home, in Congress, and so on and so forth, will lead the Obama people, it's pretty clear at this point, it's going to lead them to put more pressure on the Pakistanis. And the Pakistanis are not going to change what they're doing because of us significantly. So I think that you could find that the WikiLeaks document dump in the long run will actually heighten the problems in the area for the Obama administration.
Hmm. Final question for you, Tom. Do you foresee any of this playing a card during the upcoming congressional elections at all?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Do you foresee any of this playing a card during the upcoming congressional elections?
Oh, gosh. It's not that I don't see that as a possibility. I actually don't. It depends on how it plays out as to what role it would play there. I mean, the only thing we can say is in public opinion polls, the Afghan war is already unpopular to the degree to which it is, to the degree to which that unpopularity increases, and to the degree to which this Bush's war, and it was so much Bush's war, has become and continues to become Obama's war, to that degree, it could well play out against the Democrats. That would be a great irony, obviously, but I think it's possible.
I appreciate you coming on and all the good work you do over there. TomDispatch.com, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. Tom Engelhardt. Tom, thank you very much for being there.
It's always a pleasure, Gary.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you all over the world. Tomorrow morning, if you live on the East Coast at 3 a.m., get up. If you can't sleep or haven't gone to bed, turn on your computer and go to GaryNall.com, and then you can find a link to listen to my program on KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, 25 years. Every week, Wednesday morning, 3 to 9, West Coast, midnight to 6, I do a program. I take a lot of calls. It's a very different show than others. Each market has its own type of approach, so I think you'll enjoy it. Now for a couple comments and your calls. And I'll take your calls in just a moment. But first, from Alan Rowland, from Op-Ed News, Toxic Black Rain Falling in the Gulf. This is short but important. A toxic black rain is now falling in the Gulf, and the EPA and British Petroleum are doing everything to deny its existence. But the truth is slowly emerging as millions of Gulf Coast residents are now becoming sick because of the lethal effects of oil dispersants. It's day 97 of the toxic Gulf Deepwater oil gusher. The huge toxic slow-moving plumes beneath the surface have finally been confirmed, but the toxic air measures still being denied by the government and British Petroleum. But there is plenty of evidence that they are not only there, but causing significant health and environmental damage. And so I want people just to be aware that if you live in the Gulf area, anywhere in the Gulf area, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, and Texas, if you see that there's droplets of black that looks like soot, but a little greasy feel on your car, your houses, let me know, because we're tracking this. And if you have health problems you didn't have before, I want to know. Go to GaryNoll.com and let me know. Who tells the dead patient's story now? Donna Smith. Since the health insurance reform bill passed this past spring, you'd think we suddenly stopped having Americans' patients die and suffer unimaginable horror at the hands of the corporate-owned and operated healthcare business system in the United States. No one tells their stories. The reality is that patients were props, and they aren't needed as props anymore. An estimated 45,000 preventable deaths occurring in the United States annually due to the lack of access to appropriate health care marches on. That does not account for those dead from other preventable causes like medical error. 45,000. That's 123 every day. Today's dead, 123. Have you seen that reported anywhere? Yesterday's dead, 123. Any reports? Tomorrow's dead, 123. Is anyone trying to save those pending dead? Though more Americans die preventable deaths every year without access to health care right here at home than die in weeks on foreign battlefields, no one is searching for them in the wilderness of greed and profit-driven medicine. No one needs their painful realities right now. 123 dead today. Patients' stories were used as props by elected officials and mainstream and alternative media members and groups and advocacy groups and think tanks. Relatives of dead patients made especially good fodder for the debates. Moms and dads of dead kids were prime targets to stand up on stages, sit at witness tables, and have their names and details of the loved one's death shared with the world. Cancer patients who could not access care were pretty valuable, too. If they could still stand, think, and talk, cancer patients made for great photo ops for all and better fundraising tools for others. 123 dead tomorrow. Some may say this is to be understood as the nation has moved on to other issues following the passage of the health insurance bailout. We are now worried about jobs, the oil spill, the Arizona immigration bigotry, the leak of documents on the Afghan war. All critical issues, to be sure. Some may add that we're just now becoming aware of these numbers. But those numbers, we're told, will fall. No, they won't. 123 dead yesterday. Those insistent dead just don't stop dying. They aren't waiting for a third political party to emerge. They are the dead and dying. Patients are dying and suffering every single day in larger numbers, even as the weeks of recession roll on and medical providers become even more tightly controlled about uncompensated and undercompensated care, meaning they are protecting their bottom lines, too, and uncompensated care in the term used for patients who come without any means of payment or with inadequate means of payment. Patients are suffering more, not less. Payments are demanded up front. Patients cannot pay the thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars required for treatment. More deaths, not less. 123 people today will not die pretty, gentle, fade away into their sleep deaths with tearful loved ones at their side. They may have spent weeks or even months begging for someone to treat them. They may have been working even weeks ago were days ago but unable to get past the copay and deductibles of their insurance to get early treatment and unable to slack off for even one moment on their jobs, lest an opportunistic employer decide to lay them off based upon unspoken measures of value, like the use of sick time for doctor visits. They will die after arguments and struggles with those they leave behind as the financial pressures mounted and their illnesses deepened. I searched every news outlet page I could find to see if anyone was reporting on yesterday's dead. No one did. 123 people died, and few people even noticed their passing. I searched to see if anyone were reporting the impending slaughter of 123 innocents in the United States today. No one is reporting it. Along with the 45,000 dead, we allow 700,000 patients and their families to go belly up financially this past year. In the United States, medical crisis leads to more than 50% of the personal bankruptcies. And of those patients, 75% had health insurance. So as I saw personal bankruptcy filings rise 31.9% overall this past year, we also added more patients and their families into the deadbeat files. Even if those folks get well physically, we'll punish them forever for having gone broke. Bankruptcy, bruised credit, takes years to repair. 123 dead today, 1,917 going broke today in the midst of medical crisis. In this nation, that's happening, yet no one reports. No one. The one thing I know for sure is that the patient horror stories were certainly an integral part of the fuel that moved any debate on health reform to take place at all. The dead and dying made for a better frame for press pieces than simply selling health reform as a way to bail out the private for-profit health insurance industry and bolster the medical industrial complex overall. Patients are necessary in this system and in the debate only to the extent that without them, you cannot run the engines of medical profit. Homes lost, futures torn apart, 1917 in financial collapse today, and no one reports it. There are those who still clamor for real transformation of the United States healthcare system from the for-profit model to a social insurance model likened to Medicare. But even many of those people have somehow decided it's only the money arguments that need to be made, only the profit takers who need convincing with the language of more profit and fortunes still to be made. I disagree. I think someone must have the courage to keep reporting the healthcare war dead. In fact, I believe their faces and their names ought to be more prominent as we go forward as measures of what we are allowing to be done to allow our fellow human beings in this nation. Since the passage of the Health Care Insurance Reform Bill, March 2010, 14,670 American patients are dead, and no one spoke their names. The day we become a nation that turns its back on that much death and suffering is the day we have lost much more than a political battle. We have lost our collective soul. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go to our phones and say hello to Philip from San Diego. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Gary. Question on California locations outside of the major city area that would be that you like for singles, couples.
You would have to go up past the Napa Valley.
North,
not south. You are in a dead zone south. Southern California, the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of America, it's dying. And it will not recover. So go way north. Then you'll be fine.
So okay. the Sonoma, Napa, and county areas, and then north of there.
Yes.
I heard you mention also the other day in Arizona, I think it was Sedona, and I'm wondering why Sedona?
Sedona is a spiritual mecca in America. It's what Taos was as a artistic mecca in the 1970s and 80s. Before it went high-tech and high-gloss, and the real authentic artists, including many Native American artists, were forced out because it became too expensive. That's also true of Santa Fe. Santa Fe used to be a wonderful community of great progressive minds, and then it went Yuppieville, where people got in for the investment and the the high-end living, and now everything's too expensive. But Sedona still has a good compilation of the best, some of the best healing sites and environments. It's not yet completely spoiled. It's getting there. They're doing a lot of development. But you can go about 20 minutes out of Sedona, still keep all those beautiful red cliffs and mountains and the best of the desert. And that's a place that's I would appreciate. But once again, you got to be aware of water. Water, unless you're under a long-term historic aquifer, you're going to be hit with water problems. I know some people that moved out to west of Albuquerque, had a beautiful place. I saw photos of it, and their well went dry, and there was no other place they could get water, and so they finally had to give it up and let go of it for nothing. So you've got to do your geological surveys in depth. Take no one's word for it. Prove it. I'm looking, this morning I was looking at geological water reports and of how much water is under a homestead I wanted to buy and how long has it been there and what's the flow rate and what's the water quality. You have to do all that. Without really clean, good, abundant water, then there's no reason to be in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Seems like the Sonoma, Mendocino, that area seems to be continuing to do very well with water and food and so on.
Right.
As far as I've been able to.
Yeah, I could see that that is correct.
Mm-hmm.
You are correct.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All the best to you, Philip.
Thank you so much.
Let's get on to Washington, D.C. I don't have the person's name here. Who do we have calling from Washington, D.C.?
My name is Star.
Hi, Star.
Hi. I just wanted to amplify a little bit on the answer that was given by your guest to the question about why there is so little response today to the war in Afghanistan relative to, for instance, Vietnam. And I think that the fact that it was a citizens' army then, with all of those implications, is definitely part of it. But I think we also have to look at the fact that we have had an inundation in recent years of anti-Arab prejudice and tolerance for prejudice throughout the media and the society in a way that we really didn't prior to Vietnam. There was generalized prejudice against non-Europeans, but it wasn't the kind of intensified effort that we see now. Also, with an embedded military, we're not seeing the level of reporting on atrocities even that we saw with corporate media then. And I think people are afraid to protest these days because they're aware that civil rights are being trampled on. I mean, each time we hear about, foreign people's rights being trampled on with regard to the military oppression, we know that, we're next, and there have been people jailed who have spoken out. I also think that with all of the stop loss and the suicide rates among U.S. soldiers that theoretically would cause their families to protest the war. Right now we're in the middle of a terrible economic crunch, and so the overriding concern is that you have a job, and that seems to certainly predispose people for it to looking the other way in terms of the real role of the military. I think that the movement is kind of divided because we have an African-American president, and people still want to give him a chance. I think that's, of course, very ill-informed, and you have talked about that a lot. But I think that the biggest reason really is that there's a huge ideological shift among progressive people. The Soviet Union has collapsed. A lot of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam period was led by people who were socialist. Today, because there's not a good analysis of what happened with the Soviet Union and imperialism, a lot of progressive people are embracing what they call a third way between capitalism and communism, and it tends to be very pacifist in orientation, and it does skew the analysis because they are unwilling to really look at the fact that people have to violently react when they're confronted with violence, and that would be the people of the Middle East. And so their plans to I guess, bring about peace tend to be things that won't mobilize very many people. We also have an intensification, I think, within the peace movement of Zionist positions, and Zionism is the belief that it is all right to set up a supremacist Jewish state on Palestinian land. People are afraid to speak out too strongly, I believe, in support of any kind of Muslim or Arab resistance, because it gets very close to supporting Palestinians, and that's a huge taboo. So I think there's a lot more that could be said, but I think that all of those things need really to be considered, too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Star. Anyone else like to share their points of view, please call in. We have 4 minutes left. I'll be happy to put you on the air. 888-874-4888. Now, a couple of things. First, I have today posted my second major original investigative reporting article. I posted the first last week on the plight of homeless Gulf War veterans, of whom there are 850,000 in a given year in the United States. I also put up a video. It's on YouTube, Gary Nall, and you'll see it's a 6-part series. Today I put up the 7th part because I shot it in a different city. And last week, where I shot it for about, I think we have 7-8 minutes to this one, but it has a very powerful ethos in the beginning that you really should see. So I have 2 articles now, one about Gulf War syndrome and the cover-up and the realness of that disease process, and post-traumatic stress disorder, homelessness, and all the problems that come to a vet when they come home and they haven't been put into a state of mind to allow them to return to their families and their communities without taking into consideration what they just went through. And we should do that. So watch these videos. They're free. They're there as a public service, and read the articles. They will make a difference when you see them. Now go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, either one, and read the articles, watch the films, and pass them on to people. Share them with people. Richard from Richmond, Virginia. Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment on the unemployment extension that Congress just passed. Does not include any COBRA health extension. So that means anybody as of June 1st who got laid off will not only lose their jobs, but will no longer have the 65% subsidy that was going towards helping them pay for health insurance.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. I have been in the studio all day, so editing, so I haven't had a chance to be up to date on that, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. We're out of time now. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. And by the way, always realize that you can go to GaryNull.com, GaryNull.com, at any time to be brought up to date on what's going on. Have a good day.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.